Blog Talk Radio.
Tuesday, it's the American Sports History Podcast coming out of Cleveland, Ohio. I know the Cavaliers are sitting in the fourth seed. I know the Guardians are getting ready to play a regular season game in Cleveland. I've heard about the solar eclipse and all this other stuff. But I will tell you, tonight I'm blessed to produce this great show with a brother, a mentor, and a friend. And his guest is a brother, a mentor, and a friend to me, too. Matthew DiBiase, Peter Ray, 347-205-9631. Yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles. The sun's out. Daylight savings. The Oscars are behind us. If you happen to miss this show, archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, you listen to him more than you listen to me. As I give it over to you, Peter, the threes, how are you? How can people get a hold of you and this great guest? And, boy, the years of you and I and knowing everybody here, it is such an honor and a blessing to produce this each and every week for you, my friend.
Yeah. Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. It's my name, Peter J. Rea. You're absolutely right. Tonight's guest is the author of four tremendous sports books. Bench Bosses, the NHL's Coaching Elite 2015. The Art of the Dealers, the NHL's Greatest General Managers 2017. Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches 2019. And the book we'll continue talking about tonight, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. You've got two books coming out in 2026, Baseball's Greatest Managers and the NBA's Greatest Coaches. Welcome to the show, the incomparable Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Peter, Mark, it's so great to be back, man. It's always the most fun in the world to be on this show.
Oh, it's tremendous. This is American sports history. Every 4 weeks we get NFL history, and I just love it every time we have a show. We're going through these. We've already done the first 37 of the greatest pro football's coaches. Tonight we'll start with number 8, Jim Lee Howell.
Jim Lee Howell, yes. Okay, number 38. He, one of the most, a very obscure and forgotten coach in many ways, which is kind of a bit unfair because he made his contribution during the 1950s. I mean, according to my calculations, he was the third best NFL coach of the decade behind Paul Brown and Buddy Parker. He took over a New York Giants franchise that was really down in the dumps after a horrible 1953 season that was very well behind in terms of offensive tactics. And he basically restored it back on the winning path and got them to appear in three NFL championship games in 56, 58, and 59, and actually made them into, restored them as a powerhouse in the NFL Eastern Conference, vying with the Cleveland Browns for domination of that conference. And he was, seven of his players actually earned induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame during his coaching reign. And he had one of the greatest assistant coaching staffs in all of NFL history. He gave Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry their start in NFL coaching, gave them the freedom to use their incredible football knowledge and reap the rewards thereof of that wisdom. And basically, expanded America's awareness of the NFL, because with the growth of television in the 1950s, with the fact that the Giants were now a football power and the fact that New York was the media capital of America back then and very much controlled how the rest of America saw sports of all kinds. With the growth of TV, the Giants became like America's first telegenic team, America's first team there in that sense, since it was operating out of New York. And you're getting to see some great players, Frank Gifford, Charlie Connolly, Rosie Brown, Sam Huff on defense, Rosie Grier, Andy Robustelli, Emlyn Tennell. I mean, these were great players, and they became household names thanks to television. And it's kind of ironic that Jim Lee Howell restored New York to football greatness, because he was a product of Arkansas, a very small, tiny town called Lone Oak, Arkansas. I mean, way out there in the boonies. He was, you know, he was born and raised there, and he played at the University of Arkansas. He was an end, both offensive and defensive end, since they played both ways back then. He was tall for his time, 6'5", which was pretty big back then. Today it's rather average, but back then it was pretty big. He was drafted by the New York Giants, and he played 7 seasons with them under the great Steve Owen. Played in a few NFL championship games, like it was at 38, 39, and 44. And when World War II began, when America entered World War II, he went into the Marines, and he was a Marine Corps captain. And actually, that really developed his leadership skills. He fought out there in the Pacific, and he served. And then when the war ended, he did double duty. He was doing assistant coaching work with the Giants in the afternoons, but in the mornings he would coach at Wagner University in Staten Island. I mean, back then you could probably get away with it. Today you couldn't do that, but he was able to do that. He was doing double duty, you know, head coaching at Wagner and then doing assistant coaching with the Giants and all that. And he would do it, you know, coach in the mornings at Wagner and then take the ferry and then the subway up to the Polo Grounds and just coach the Giants. And he did that until 1953, and that's when the Giants fired Steve Owen, who had been their coach since 1931, because the team had finished 3-9. They're in dismal shape. Their offense was basically non-existent, and basically other NFL teams had figured out the famous umbrella defense. And basically, Owens was put out to pasture, and Jim Lee Howell was hired to basically revamp the whole team. In other words, modernize the team tactically, just go out there, get the best coaches, and just bring the Giants, you know, offense and defense into the 1950s, bring it up to date. And that's exactly what he did. He got a promising young head coach from West Point who served under Red Blake named Vincent T. Lombardi and made him his offensive coordinator. And what Vince Lombardi did was he brought the power sweep and the halfback option pass into the Giants' offensive repertoire. And also he convinced Jim Lee Howell to make Frank Gifford the fulcrum of that offense. And that really, and Gifford in his own memoir said what Lombardi did was he helped make his Hall of Fame career possible, because before that he was struggling with the Giants. And thus he launched Frank Gifford's career to NFL immortality. And on defense, Jim Lee Howell convinced defensive back Tom Landry that you're a defensive genius. I want you to be my defensive coordinator. And what Tom Landry did was he helped modernize. He took Steve Owens' 4-3 umbrella defense and converted into the inside-outside 4-3 defense, and basically revolutionized NFL defensive play. You know, reading keys. You know, aggressive study, noting tendencies and anticipating plays. And that 4-3 defense helped make, you know, Sam Huff an NFL Hall of Famer, and I believe was it Robustelli and Rosie Greer NFL Hall of Famers too, and Emlyn Tunnell. They went into the NFL Hall of Fame. They became one of the finest defenses in the NFL because of Landry's tactics. Now, I know Jim Howell has always earned his fair share of criticism, basically saying, oh, he had Lombardi and Howell. He was no real genius. He left the genius up to them. He really didn't. He was nothing but a push button head coach. And I think that's unfair. And in some ways, Howell kind of contributed to that, because there was a famous remark he made when they asked him, how do you do it? He said, oh, I just let them do their jobs, and all I do is keep the footballs inflated. It was just self-deprecating humor. But what people don't realize is that, yes, he had two great geniuses in Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry. But his genius was that he left them alone. You see, he didn't have to do that. He could have micromanaged. He could have interfered. I mean, there are instances where head coaches have interfered with their subordinates, you know, just micromanaged or just got in the way or just, you know, was jealous of a brilliant assistant coach. There are numerous instances of that. You know, he could have ignored their recommendations. He could have, you know, just disregarded it. But Jim Lee Howell's brilliance was that he didn't do that. He let them have their way. He saw that he had two 24-karat gold assistant coaches. He gave them freedom. He gave them space. He let them paint their brilliant canvases, both on offense and defense, and the end result was New York Giants in 1956 appeared in their first NFL championship game since 1946, and they beat the Chicago Bears overwhelmingly, 47-7, and that was their first NFL championship since 1938, and all of a sudden the Giants were, you know, they were back in the saddle again. They were great. They had a great team. And, okay, in the following year, they failed to repeat because the Cleveland Browns had Jim Brown. But then in 58 and 59, again, they won the Eastern Conference title. I mean, just they had a brilliant offense. You know, they had Kyle Rote, you know, Frank Gifford, Alex Webster, you know, Charlie Connolly, you know, orchestrating the offense. They had a great offensive line with Rosie Brown, Jack Stroud, Ray Witeka at center. And that defense, oh, what an incredible defense. You've got Sam Huff, Big Ed Macielewski, Rosie Greer, Andy Robustelli, Harlan Zvari, you know, a great secondary, and Jim Patton, Dick Lynch, you know, Emlyn Tennell. It was a fantastic secondary. They could make the big plays that needed to be made. They had a great place kicker in Pat Summerall, you know, a clutch field goal kicker. And in the 58 and 59 NFL championship games, they lost to the Baltimore Colts. But people forget that overtime game in 58, one of the greatest NFL games ever played. I mean, the Giants had a shot. I mean, if it weren't for the fact that they just couldn't stop Johnny Unitas, they had a shot at winning and all of that. And, Howell was a great coach. And the thing is, the pressures, I mean, it just started eating away at him. Even though they were a great winning team, it just, he had trouble dealing with the pressures of coaching in New York City. I mean, he was an Arkansas country lad. And basically, the reason why he stayed till 1960 was he thought he could win another championship. Had he won in 58, he would have retired right then and there. So he tried again in 59. Again, they lost. But if they had won in 59, he would have quit right then and there. So finally, he was going to try for 60, and had it not for the fact that they lost back-to-back games to the Philadelphia Eagles in 1960, that's what cost them the Eastern Conference title, you know, those losses there. Had they won both games, they would have won, you know, the Eastern Conference title and faced the Green Bay Packers in the NFL championship game, but it didn't happen. And finally, Jim Lee Howell, he just, you know, he called it quits. He had enough. And basically, he just got kicked upstairs and accepted a front office job with the Giants and just stayed there for the rest of his days, just, you know, quietly working there. But, you know, he was a great coach. He was very high intensity. I mean, yeah, he had great assistants, but he was the man in charge, and he was quite a fiery presence. I mean, Gifford himself a couple of times was stung, you know, because, you know, Howell would, you know, give tongue lashings, and ironically, it was Vince Lombardi who later became famous for his high-intensity tongue lashings. He would apply the healing balm to Frank Gifford in that sense. But, I mean, Jim Lee Howell was a great coach, and he should be remembered and commemorated. And that's all I have to say about Jim Lee Howell. So shall we move along? Peter, shall we move along?
Well, I just have a few things to say about him based on your chapter. Yeah, I don't think I had heard that name, but certainly a lot of famous names jump out from his life and his coaching. You said that the Giants were the most telegenic team of the 50s. You talked about the 1958 NFL championship, which had the nickname the greatest game ever played, which is so cool. And then, yeah, you talked about him being misunderstood and unappreciated. And then all these, let's see, and then his playing career when he helped the Giants, you know, win a title in 38. And then these names you're throwing out here, Frank Gifford, of course, for me, beloved from Monday Night Football in the 70s, and then, Charlie Connerly. And then, just imagine, assistant coaches Vince Lombardi and Tom Landry, incredible. Rosie Greer, who was a bodyguard for Robert F. Kennedy when he died in 1968. All kinds of great stuff here. And so it's really good that you brought this guy, or given him attention. And then the quote by him, Being a slave driver just wasn't my nature. I was never a dedicated football man. It got so bad in 1959, I was sacrificing everything, my life and my family, to football. I'd spend all day at practice, snapping at my players, and take my snarling disposition home with me. I couldn't sleep and I couldn't unwind. It just wasn't worth it anymore. It reached a point where I couldn't stand to lose, and I didn't get a kick out of winning. And then you, so that's great that you, wonderful chapter on Jim Lee Howe. Now let's move on to number 39, Tom Flores.
Tom Flores, you know, I interviewed him in July of 2019. This was like 8 months before he was, eight or nine months before he was inducted in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and he was absolutely magnificent with me. Fantastic interview, just a kind and sweet man, and we got into the depths of his career and everything, the glories, everything of his career. And he was just a great man, and I was so glad when he finally earned induction. I was a long overdue moment. He should have been inducted years before and all that. But that's the question in my mind, is why did it take so long? I mean, he was the first Hispanic man ever to coach a Super Bowl winner. He was also the first man ever to play on a Super Bowl winner, which was the Kansas City Chiefs in Super Bowl IV, then win as an assistant coach with the Raiders in Super Bowl XI, then head coach a Super Bowl winner in his own right in Super Bowl XV. Yeah, he's the first guy to ever do that. He was the second greatest head coach in Raiders franchise history in terms of games coached, regular season wins, playoff games coached, and playoff wins. However, he surpassed John Madden in Super Bowl appearances and titles. And his playoff winning percentage was superior to that of Bill Belichick, Bill Walsh, Joe Gibbs, Jimmy Johnson, Tom Landry, Chuck Knoll, and yet they got in the Hall of Fame before he did. I mean, you know, why was he forced to wait? And one reason was it was his own nature. Flores was a very quiet man, kind of like Blanton Collier, you know, who we talked about months ago. You know, I think it was like a year ago. You know, he wasn't one to toot his own horn. And the thing is, to get into the Hall of Fame, you got to be willing to bang your own drums or have people bang the drums for you. And luckily, you know, he had people out there who was banging the drums for him. I remember just before he was inducted, there was that beer campaign, you know, enlist support. And thankfully, it worked. Thank God and all that. He was born in Fresno, California. He was the son of Mexican immigrants. And he basically, you know, his youth, they were working as sharecroppers, picking fruit. Finally, his father owned a small store. He didn't start playing football until he was in junior high. But, you know, he had a knack for the game. He was a quarterbacking star for his high school team. And, in fact, later that high school where he went with, they named their football stadium after him. He didn't play in any major colleges. He played in Fresno City College and then he went to the University of the Pacific. He wasn't drafted by the NFL, and he didn't make it in the Canadian Football League. So basically, he was playing semi-pro ball. And in 59, he tried out for the Washington Redskins. Didn't get it. And actually, he was getting ready to chuck football. He was going to, you know, just work, you know, as a teacher. He was working to, you know, get a physical education. And then suddenly, the AFL was born. And that meant all the difference in the world. The Oakland Raiders, were looking for talent. Flores came down, and he became an original Oakland Raider. And from like 60 to 66, he was their starting quarterback. Not exactly a super quarterback like Jack Kemp was, or like Len Dawson, or George Blanda was in the early days of the AFL. But he was solid. He was competent. He was decent, but not great. He wasn't a superstar. And then in 67, the Raiders traded him to the Buffalo Bills in exchange for Daryl LaMonica. And basically, Flores spent the rest of his playing career essentially as a backup quarterback. And after 1970, he quit as a player, but he took up coaching in 71. He was working as a quarterback's coach for the Buffalo Bills. And then in 72, he went back to Oakland. And there he was working under John Madden. First, he was a wide receivers coach. As a wide receivers coach for the remainder of John Madden's tenure up to 78. So he was there during those glory years with the Raiders, and he was observing You know, he was working with Al Davis. He was working with Madden. He was watching how Madden was doing his job and all that. Can you hear me?
Can't hear you.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Not really.
Hello.
Can't hear you, Matthew.
I can hear you, Peter.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Can you hear me now?
No, it's very broken.
I can hear you fine.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Can't hear you.
Oh, dear. I'll keep talking, okay? John Madden quit in 78. Flores took over. And he did a couple of changes. He wanted to introduce the shotgun formation, which Al Davis never cared much for and Madden didn't use. But he wanted to use the shotgun because other teams were using the shotgun. And basically the Raiders were a team in transition. The team that fueled the 70s was kind of giving way. You were getting new talents in. Miss Stabler was gone. You had Jim Plunkett coming in. You had guys like Howie Long coming in, Matt Mellon. They were coming in, Lester Hayes. And it was rough for a time, but then the Raiders started taking off. They became the first wild card team ever to make it to the Super Bowl and then win a Super Bowl when they beat the Eagles in Super Bowl 15. And then they remained competitive. And then in the 83, they beat the Washington Redskins there in the Super Bowl. And ironically, they became the last AFC team to win a Super Bowl. And for the next 14 years, the AFC went on an extended losing streak. So that was like the answer to a trivia question. But, I mean, in that Super Bowl win against the Redskins, I mean, they just tore the skins apart. I mean, their defense contained, John Riggins, the Washington's running game. They took away their passing game. Marcus Allen, was a star there. He exploded. He gained great yardage there. Plunkett was able to complete his passes. It was one of the great performances in Super Bowl history. And to this day, it's still the last Super Bowl triumph of the Raiders, the Los Angeles Raiders, as it were. But then right after that, the team just kind of grew old and declined and fell. And finally, Tom Flores was kind of losing. I mean, he told me this. He said he was kind of losing his edge. And he and Al Davis just decided that it was time for him to step down. And for a time, he was out of circulation. And then he decided to be general manager of the Seattle Seahawks. And actually, I think that kind of hurt him in terms of the Hall of Fame because he tried to rebuild the Seahawks, but he didn't do so good. He came back as a head coach, and he had three very lousy seasons. And that really damaged him. And I think that kind of contributed to the fact that that delayed his induction in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. They were focusing on that, and I think that kind of served as like negative counterweights against him. But finally, he finally retired, and finally he earned induction into the Pro Football Hall and got his just due. And he was a very vastly underrated coach and a great coach and a great man too.
Yeah, he's another guy who deserves attention, so it's wonderful that you're giving him that. He was overshadowed by John Madden and Al Davis, guys like that. And, yeah, the American dream, son of Mexican immigrants. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And he talked about how he played in every AFL game, something like that. And I didn't know he had a good playing career. You mentioned him being a backup for Jack Kemp. And let's see. And then his course coming to the Raiders. And then they actually, that's one of the most memorable Cleveland teams, 1980, when the Browns lost a tough, very tough game in the playoffs here in Cleveland. And Jim Plunkett, who had taken over for Dan Pastorini. So Jim Plunkett's remembered. Yeah, he was a cool guy, too. I think he had an American Indian background. So that's cool. That was a real cool team. And then, of course, they won in Oakland and in L.A. So in the time when they were in L.A., he won a Super Bowl there. All these cool players, Marcus Allen. And it's wonderful that you got a chance to talk with him on the phone.
Yeah, like I said, a great guy. I mean, absolutely friendly. He was actually tickled pink that I was considering him for the book, and he told me, about his tactics. You know, he said he liked to, come up with big plays. You know, it just, what was he looking for? He said, what was he into? You like to sum it up this way. You said you have to have confidence in what you do. You have to have passion in what you do, and you have to do what you want to do rather than what someone else wants you to do. He said, don't try to coach someone else's team, and don't try to coach like somebody else. You said you coach like you want to be coached, but don't forget to use their expertise. It's like coming in and doing something like someone else does, which doesn't work. You need to do what you do best in that sense, and that's what he did. And he did it very, very well.
You wrote he remained accessible to anyone who needed his insights and memories about pro football's past and was most gracious to those football historians who advocated for his induction into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, including this writer. I love that line there. Now, we have some comments here. Let's see. Let me find them here. Albert from Poway, California, talking about Jack Pardee, George Allen, and Mike Martz.
Well, George Allen will be featured. Actually, 4 weeks from now, we'll be talking about George Allen, so stay tuned, okay? We'll be talking about him next month. We will, that's guaranteed. Pardee, no, not featured in the book. Actually, he was a heartbreak coach. That's one reason why he didn't make the top 50. He never got into the Super Bowl, although ironically, he did win the championship in the World Football League, though. And Mike Martz, no, didn't crack top 50. He was like somewhere in the 50s. I forget what my rating was. If he had coached longer and beaten the Patriots in that Super Bowl, was it 35 or something like that, he probably would have cracked the top 50, according to my calculations.
Frank from Bellingham, Washington. Great show, fellas. Frank Gifford was a stud, would have been a great coach. Yeah, Frank Gifford, any thoughts on him?
You know, of the Monday Night Football, the original Monday Night Football trio, he was my fave. I mean, I always preferred him over Dandy Don and Humble Howard. He was the straight man. He provided the sanity amidst the chaos and madness brought on by Dandy Joe Don, and Dandy Don and Humble Howard and all that. I always liked Gifford. He was what he was. He was a great football player. And I always liked his presence in front of the camera. He was a pro at ABC's Wild World of Sports. He was a workhorse, him with Jim McKay. He just, he was a legend and all of that. And, I mean, God rest his soul.
Yeah, I remember that's my childhood. Howard Cosell, Don Meredith, and Frank Gifford, those three guys were magic, absolute magic. And I had no, I was just a kid. I had no idea at the time what a tremendous NFL playing career Frank Gifford had until years later when I read his book and all this cool, playing experience with the New York Giants in the 50s. Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, getting back to Jim Lee Howe, and a playoff game against the Cleveland Browns to decide who was going to play in the 58 NFL championship game. They used a beautiful trick play that the players in Lombardi devised. Connerly handed off to Alex Webster, who then handed it off to Frank Gifford, who went around right end with Charlie Connerly kind of trailing behind him. And when a Cleveland Browns defender approached Frank Gifford attacking him, what Gifford did was he lateraled it to Charlie Connerly. Now, Connerly was football ancient, yet he wheezed about 9-10 yards for the game's only touchdown. But it worked. It was the only touchdown, and it was enough to win the game 10-0 for the Giants, and they went on to play the Colts in the 58 NFL championship game. But typical of the Lombardi's razzle-dazzle and the fact that Jim Lee Howell let him get away with that.
Our guest has been Mr. Matthew DiBiase. We've been talking about continuation of his book, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. The time has run out. Matthew, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
Yes, my next podcast will be Thursday night at 8 o'clock, where I'll be interviewing World War II documentarian Tim Gray.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. We're going to have Matthew DiBiase back in 4 weeks from tonight, April 9th. We'll talk about George Allen, who coached the L.A. Rams and Washington Redskins, and Chuck Knox, coached the L.A. Rams, Buffalo Bills, and Seattle Seahawks. Next week, we're going to have Bill North, who was an MLB center fielder from 1971 to 1981 with the Chicago Cubs, Oakland A's, L.A. Dodgers, and San Francisco Giants. Dear listener, may the thanks so much, Matthew, for coming on the show tonight. Wonderful, wonderful NFL history show again.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks forever and a day.
God bless you. Thank you. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again so much, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Take care, Peter. God bless you.
God bless you.
Okay. Bye-bye.